Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to the panel discussion. If we let the theme roll long enough, all of our panelists will be here. And that's exactly what happened. I'm very happy.
That was really kind of...
No, you know what? I'm not being mean to you. I'm just saying because we get letters from audience members who say, "Why do you let the music go?" Because, and I just want people to know that we're not always ready.
We were ready. Rehearsing.
Yeah, rehearsing. You're doing.
We got here really early this time too. We were out there for a long time.
Some of us are ready.
Yeah, we're ready.
Yeah.
Where have you guys
been?
Hey,
Bob and Terry been here for hours.
They were ready
to go.
Chris's fault.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the roundtable for this Wednesday, the 18th of September, 14 minutes past the hour, and very nice to have you with us. We have a lot to talk about. We will get to it in just a moment. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. I realize I haven't said this in a while, so let me just remind you about your letters. Keep them short, keep them to the point, and keep them on topic. Don't include links or attachments. We can't open them. We don't open them. We're not going to open them. And it makes us just sort of skip over them. Not sort of. We just skip over them. Don't use abbreviations. Please proofread before you send. But we love your letters. Feel free to send them. Also, you know, if you've written 5 or 7 today, maybe just give somebody else a chance. That's the other thing. And also, we can't get to every letter, so don't think it's against you. It's just if we have 8 letters basically saying the same thing, we're only going to read 1 or 2.
I don't give that many instructions for class assignments. Do you care?
I haven't given those instructions in a long time, but I feel that both Sarah and I feel that it's often good to do to remind folks. We can reference back. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you, sir?
Good morning, sir. And as far as I'm concerned, I love the music this morning, so I had no problem with it.
Oh, good, good. Yeah, it's toe-tapping. Terrence Blanchard is who it is. All right, Times Union columnist Chris Churchill joins us. Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Good. I'm really good. Glad to be here.
Good, good. Yeah. Really good.
Everything's good.
Hope we don't screw that up.
Investigative sounds a little more enthusiastic than usual.
Investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo is here. Good morning, Rosemary.
Good morning.
SUNY New Paltz communications professor and former New York State Senator Terry Gibson is on the program. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning. You know, it's just like being in class. I wait for my students to roll in so I can get busy, and I'm waiting and waiting. It's just like being in class here.
You should take attendance. And scolded Chris. I think we should do a walkout.
I think we should leave, yeah. Yeah.
Walkout, yes. Yeah.
Take our show on the road.
Do it without us.
And the dean, who was here early, of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security and Cybersecurity at the University of Albany, Bob Griffin is with us. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. I hate being late, so I'm sure my family is laughing when they're listening to this. Like, yeah, he gets to the airport 3 hours early because, you know.
Again, Rosemary and I were both here early. It was a member of the WAMC staff who waylaid us with conversation and... And we actually had to pull ourselves away.
So I don't know the answer to this question, but let me guess. Gustina?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Sorry, David.
Just out of curiosity.
You
okay. Good morning and welcome to the... That really has less to do with David than it does with... I was pretty sure it wasn't Ray. good morning, everyone, and welcome. Let's get started. We have a lot to talk about. All right. So there was an election, of course. Rosemary has been telling us about this for days, about the importance of this election, and saying that this is a story that is getting lost in the morass of everything else. But after tight Israeli election, Netanyahu's tenure appears perilous. So you look at this and you think to yourself, well, this is what we know. We know that that Netanyahu, nor his chief rival, Benny Gantz, had enough to form a majority coalition. But the upshot being, okay, but you still, that is not a great showing for Netanyahu. What does that mean for his future? What does that mean for the next steps in Israel? Alan.
Well, first of all, the American people really don't know Gantz, but he is an interesting guy in that he represents what I think a lot of American Judaism believes in, which is, you know, a a democratic Israel, one that is not consumed by a small religious group, which has always maintained the clout to be able to decide what's going to be, and everybody has to kowtow to. So I think it's an interesting election, and frankly, it is pretty much what we all expected. In other words, it was a do-over. 1% more voted than had voted before, but we don't know who that 1% was. And now we'll have to see what the president of Israel, who will have to call on somebody and probably Gantz, to come up with a government will do.
Alan, don't we know that there was a big Arab turnout and that contributed to Netanyahu's defeat, that he kind of overplayed his hand with some of the threats and some of the intimidation tactics that he attempted to use?
You know, that's a great question, Chris. And the reason is that he decided he was going to make them the reason that Israelis should turn out and vote for him in large numbers. And they were going to be the boogeymen. Mm-hmm. Whether that worked or not, we don't know yet. But certainly it's what he did. And what I kept thinking all night as I was reading the headlines, pardon me, was, what is this going to mean to, average Israelis who really treasure their independence and the country? And that's why Netanyahu has always won, because they always worried that somebody would get in their faces and take over the country. Certainly the rhetoric from Hamas and some of the others have been right along those lines. So it is a very courageous thing that the Israeli people are doing here.
I'm not ready to write off Netanyahu yet. I wouldn't call the election yesterday. It was as close as I thought it would be. You think about what is at stake for Netanyahu. It isn't just losing power. He could go to jail. Yeah. He is facing serious corruption charges. He has protected in office. He passed legislation, which I know Donald Trump would like, and has it in the form of the guidelines from the Justice Department. If you're in office in Israel, you cannot be prosecuted. That changes if he loses.
And while you're on the subject, Rosemary, what about Trump? I mean, Trump has just done about everything he could, right, but personally campaign for Netanyahu. Right. Let's assume Netanyahu doesn't form the government. What does Trump do?
Right. I things are definitely changing if he gets out. And what is at stake for the Israeli people is the nature of what they want to be. Netanyahu has gotten more and more strident that it's not going to include Arabs and that he is going to annex the West Bank. He is going to turn Israel into a Jewish, not a secular state, and that there will be no two-state solution. He's very, very hard line. And what you see in the election and what you see in the opposition he now faces is more of a willingness to be the real Israel, which includes Arabs. And yes, Arabs did turn out in great numbers, and good for them. And they were right to do that, because their existence is at stake. Their existence as citizens of Israel is definitely at stake.
Bob Griffin.
Yeah, it's an election that truly is the fight for the soul of Israel. And Rosemary, I thought you're spot on with the sort of weirdness that Netanyahu really does face some potentially significant jail time given charges if he's not prime minister.
Right.
What's interesting to me is some of the tactics that Netanyahu used that we saw in the 2016 election, sort of the argument about voter fraud from minority groups, targeting minorities. It's almost a very similar playbook to what we saw here, and that's scary. The Arab vote becomes a very interesting conversation because if you look at the population of Arab Israelis, they're actually starting to have more votes than the Jewish Israelis, and this is going to be an interesting election to watch. It could be a bellwether, particularly as the political strength of the Arab community starts to flex its muscles, and that is a concern. I know that folks in Israeli politics have had for a long time. I also agree with you. I'm not writing off Netanyahu yet. I think you know, the president put him in last time, and mm-hmm. and it'll
could
be interesting
well do it
to
again.
See the
right. right.
The other element that I think is important to raise as part of the discussion is the Netanyahu has basically had to move so far to the right in order to preserve a coalition that the Likud party is almost indistinguishable from where it began. And again, I look at elements of our own GOP and what's happening with the GOP and movement to the right, but also with our Democratic Party moving to the left, and I see the party extremes as being something that we should all be watching, not just in Israel but also here.
I agree with everything that's been said. I am particularly intrigued with the relationship between Netanyahu and Donald Trump, and how this election could reflect badly on Donald Trump. And I certainly personally hope that anything that reflects badly on Trump does come to pass and happen. I am curious, I think maybe just ask Rosemary, because she seems to be very knowledgeable in this. Is the position between, as it relates to Palestine, as it relates to dealing with Palestine, is the position that Netanyahu has towards Palestine and what Gantz has towards Palestine, are they radically different, or are they very similar?
I think that they are similar, but Gantz has been more careful in expressing it, as up until this time, Netanyahu used to be. He would say, oh, yeah, we have hope for a two-state solution. He's dropped all that now. He's become nakedly a Zionist, and Gantz is not.
Yeah, that's what I'm reading, is that there are similarities there, but neither of them have taken a really strong position. In terms of adopting a two-state solution.
That yes, they're politically really just, dangerous yeah, right. to do
look,
that.
Look, I think, you know, Rosemary, I let you say what you said before because I want to be careful here. But if you ask Gantz and you ask Netanyahu and you ask the Israeli people, the Jews in Israel, whether or not Israel is a Jewish state, you're going to get an emphatic yes. Yes.
Well, it's law now. They passed a law. It definitely
yeah.
is.
No, there's no question about that. So I think we have to be very careful that this is not an election which was going to, you know, ratify the idea of a two-state solution, which, you know, I think you're much better off with Gantz, obviously, than Netanyahu. But I do think, you know, you can't frame this in a way that it is not realistic.
I'm not sure what that means.
Well, it means is that Israelis consider Israel, which it was founded on, to be a Jewish state, right?
Well, as I say, it's now emblazoned in law that it is. But so what then is the role of the Arab citizens? That doesn't change in an Arab state. Mm. You still have to figure out what their role is. And many Palestinians don't want a two-party state. They always wanted a one-party state in which they had real, full, complete rights and more autonomy than they definitely do now. And they don't want walls. And there's the whole what does a one-party state in which Palestinians are treated fairly, what does that look like? What they really want is a one-party state in which they're in charge and they give rights to Jewish citizens.
Well, and as
I admit that. Maybe that's what you mean, Alan.
Well, as you know, Hamas and others have said, drive the Israelis into the sea, and they mean it. You're not living there.
I think that is really outdated. Hamas says a lot of things, but it's mostly rhetoric, and no one believes that's really going to happen. On the street, Palestinian and Jewish citizens are coming closer and closer. They don't like what's happened. Many Jewish citizens of Israel do not like that they are occupiers, which is what they are, and would argue for something other than what exists now. The question of Israel's right to exist has been settled. That is not in question. That's just a talking point you hear when apologists for Israel want to shut down the conversation.
I don't know about that. Yeah. I mean, it's settled here. We may consider it settled, but I don't think the great majority of the population of the Middle East considers it settled.
I didn't see that when I was there, Chris.
Yeah. So I would argue that, you know, for both Hamas and Hezbollah and others that it isn't settled, and I think always, you know, the preserving the state is going to be a key element of the Israeli government's position. It's interesting to me is that in conversations I've had with folks in Israel, you know, there's a lot of support for a two-state system, and really it goes back to demographics. Again, what they recognize is that, you know, by consuming all of the lands that they're consuming, they become a minority. The Jewish vote becomes a minority in a state that they believe to be Jewish. In the Arab vote and coming out and, you know, gasp, the Arab voters actually voted, is a major change in Israeli politics. But without a two-state solution at some point in time, the Israeli Jewish vote is going to be a minority vote.
Right, and then Israel as we know it or as it was created ceases to exist, essentially. Yeah. Which is this is kind of Netanyahu's line, though, right? This is exactly what he's been saying all these years about the existential threat.
It is, except where Rosemary is correct, though, is that, you know, you walk down, you know, the streets of most communities, and I say most communities, staying outside of the sort of ultra-Orthodox areas, and they're it's a mixing bowl. Mm-hmm. And I will tell, I mean, if anyone who's listening, you know, Tel Aviv is one of my favorite cities in the entire world. I think the people are amazing. The city is amazing. And it really, to me, is heartening of what the modern Israel state can be. I mean, it's certainly a beacon of hope to me when I look at Tel Aviv.
Which is why the president moved the capital, recognition of the capital to Jerusalem as opposed to Tel Aviv. And I couldn't agree with you more about, you know, how wonderful Tel Aviv is. It's really something.
Wait, why did he move it to Jerusalem?
Well, I have about 20 seconds, but go ahead.
He moved it to Jerusalem because he doesn't like the idea of a homogeneous country.
Okay.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll return to our discussion after this short break. Thank you very much for being with us. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Alan Shartok, Terry Gibson, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo are here. We will go to letters in a second. Let's move on to another story, which is just breaking as we're talking about this. We have a new national security advisor that has been named by the president. Robert O'Brien is the man's name, and we're just finding out about this, so we will try to find out a little more about him. Also, that the president has announced that he is ordering new sanctions on Iran. That is the other story that is breaking this morning. And the president saying that he's ordered new sanctions. The latest that's escalating the tensions between the two, that, of course, following the attack over the weekend of the oil facilities on Saudi oil facilities. So the president said that he has instructed the Secretary of the Treasury to substantially increase the sanctions on the country of Iran. I am going to plead ignorance on this, and because I don't know what more is there to sanction.
Yeah, that would be my question too.
Yeah. I mean, if there wasn't a saying, like, what is there to do? I guess, Bob, do you have a sense?
No, I'd assumed that we had put all of the sanctions in that we could have put in when we took the hardline position. So, it almost rings false to me. It sort of rings that we're going to do something. When actually we're really not doing anything. I will note that you know, Robert O'Brien was the top hostage affairs official with the State Department. Maybe he can negotiate the release of our intelligence community, because it seems to be held hostage right now. So maybe that'll be a good thing.
Nice. Very nice.
Yeah, I'm not even sure why this makes the news, this new announcement about sanctions, because Trump is a liar. He's a documented liar. There's no statistics or evidence or information put with this tweet, and as far as we know, it's just talk with no action behind it, which more and more seems to be pretty much the way Trump governs. It's all talk with no action, no follow-through.
You know, Terry, I think you're onto a good point, though. I think that he's getting pressure. So even within his own party, you know, for the hawks that supported Bolton and now Bolton's gone are saying you've got to do something. And it does appear like he's weak in his policy statement. So this is a tough statement that actually has no teeth behind it.
And as for the security advisor, which we're all learning more about right now, I don't know why anybody would want this job. Trump is already on record saying very clearly that this is an easy job. All you have to do is what I tell you to do. That's it. I mean, he's on record as saying that very recently. So, you know, to come into a position like this and think that you're going to be able to offer this president some type of advice and he's going to listen to you, there's no record to indicate that that's true. So I just question why anybody would want the job in the first place.
I think that's somewhat naive, to be honest with you, and I don't mean that to be cruel or mean. I think it's naive. Look, more than a third of this country voted for Trump. Many people in this country are right-wing as can possibly be and are delighted to do whatever he tells them to and to have that position. So that's why they would want the job. You say, you don't understand why anybody would want
power,
the job.
I mean, power,
right? That's sure.
Yeah, and also you look at somebody like, although to Terry's point, you have somebody like John Bolton and you see how that ends. And John Bolton's great. Everybody says John Bolton is the choice. No, he's great. He's the best guy. And then, you know, you send him out and say what an idiot he is. I assume everyone in this room has skepticism of how long this particular gentleman will last.
Well, I mean, they get the life expectancy of a fruit fly. I mean, he's number four, right? And
yeah.
You know, I'll bet the over in Vegas of six before Trump goes up for re-election. So I think we're looking probably at two more before the 2020 election.
We don't know this. We don't know enough about O'Brien. He could be another Pompeo who actually generally believes and thinks the same as Trump and everything will be fine.
We could. I'm just saying that position yet doesn't lend itself to that level of sustainability.
Well, I keep saying, why do we have a national security advisor, at least in this administration? It has not worked as it has in previous ones as the broker of information who brings everything together and gives the full panoply of choices to the president. He doesn't want that.
I mean, to Alan's point, though, there's a lot of mileage to be done as a former, you know, even if you get booted, you're still a former national security advisor. I do have to chuckle every time I see Scaramucci on and they refer to him as former White House spokesman. He was spokesman for like an hour and a half. Like,
he could end up on Dancing with the Stars.
He could get a book deal. He could be. He'll be on cable news. I mean, yeah.
But in all seriousness, this job really is, you know, what the title indicates. It is someone who is really there to advise the president, and all presidents, you know, prior to this one, have at least had someone in the role that they respected, that they would listen to, that they would consider, even if their position was opposite of theirs. And that's just not what Trump wants. He wants to be surrounded with yes men.
I would just point out that this is not a long-term position. We've only had it since like the end of World War II.
Well, that's a while.
And you don't need it in the cabinet.
I'm not fighting for it.
And you don't make anybody Secretary of State or National Security Advisor who isn't somewhat in line with your views, right? I mean, come on now. This is not as if they're putting some potentate up there who will disagree with the president on a regular basis. Of course, we don't know because these are pretty, my mind is not going well here, but they are pretty obviously secret negotiations that go on all the time. So we don't really know. But I would advise all of you that if you're Obama or somebody else, you don't appoint anybody to that position without having some confidence that you and that person are on the same wavelength.
Well, he didn't do that with Bolton. He never really liked Bolton.
This is a guy who wants to be president of the United States again. And everything that he does ought to be considered as part of that formula. And the formula in this case of Bolton was he was convenient for a little while to show the right-wing flank. That's what it was about.
I'm still a strong supporter of the position. I think the DNI is critical in a system where we have so many different intelligence agencies, each having a little bit of the picture, in adjudicating among those different needs is still really important. And in a perfect world, the DNI becomes a you know, a counterweight that can give the president some very blunt and honest assessments that don't always come from other elements of the intelligence community. And I don't see that happening right now in the current administration. With that said, I think long term, though, it would be a big mistake to get rid of the DNI and the ODNI, Office of the Director of National Intelligence.
Let me get back to the sanctions for a second. The White House, the State Department, nobody is responding yet to elaborate on the president's tweet as to what those sanctions will be. Apparently, they come after the Iran warned the U.S. of a broad retaliation in case there was any attack. This from the Washington Post. In the wake of crippling strikes on the Saudi oil industry, Iran condemned remarks by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and other officials linking the country with the attack. So how long does this play out, Bob?
So the more I dig into the open source information on the attack, the more disturbed I am. It wasn't just a drone attack. I've seen some talk of cruise missile and drone. So So we're talking about a potential for a really relatively sophisticated, coordinated attack that there's no way Houthi rebels had the capacity to do this. So I look at this as a really major expansion of a more hot war in the Gulf than we've seen, the sort of the religious cold war between the Saudis and the Iranians. And I think my feeling is that the Iranians sense that there is an inherent weakness in our policy and that they're really going to push to see where the edge goes.
I've read this too, but I don't know where we get the idea that the Houthis should be discounted. I don't quite get that. They have carried out quite sophisticated, and they work with experts from Iran and elsewhere, so why could they not do it? And second, I think this is not directed at Iran and Saudi. I think this is Iran versus the U.S. over the sanctions and over the Trump's sanctions are hurting them desperately, and they are becoming more and more desperate. And we, instead of responding, as I thought Trump at least was leading towards, let's talk with them. Diplomacy will end this, not more militaristic saber rattling or actual actions. I think they have less and less to lose.
Well, they are moving towards diplomacy, though, right? I mean,
that was
the idea. And there's one line of thought that the strike was designed by hardliners within Iran to kind of head off any sort of negotiation or any sort of diplomacy.
So if you're right, Chris, the question then from all of us is, what do we do? Because I happen to be one of the people who think it's very likely that this is Iranian, and that so what do we do in terms of our policy?
Beats me. I mean, to go back to what Robert said, we've been fighting this proxy war in Yemen for a long time. And I say we intentionally because we have been involved in that proxy war. The danger of proxy wars is that they can turn into real wars, right? And if Iran struck Saudi Arabia, in a sense, it's just an extension of what's already happening. I almost don't know how we can see that as something to be upset about.
Last question, very quickly. What do you make of the fact that there is such reticence on the part of Saudi Arabia and the president to go any further in terms of heating this up?
I think it's because they're looking down the barrel of a full scale war, and I think that I think the Saudis are really concerned about appearing weak to Iranian aggression. I think there are whole elements of the Middle East that are holding their breath to see if this is a continued Iranian ascendancy and the decline of both the U.S. and Saudi stopgap against against where Iran is. And again, I'll go back. You know, we may be the United States may be the great devil to Iran, but the second devil is the Saudi and their view of Islam, which is we're getting into a religious war religious war between the Saudis and the Iranians, which is we have not seen in a long time.
And to go back to where we started, wouldn't the third devil be Israel?
I mean, the third devil
this
definitely
all ties together.
And you know, Chris,
course, that was one of the things that I've thought is that if this attack had gone against Israel, what would our policy be?
Yeah.
But, you know, I will disagree one thing, Rosemary. I do think the level of sophistication of this attack, the pinpoint nature, the ability to take down not just hit the refineries, but take down key elements of the refinery, points to me more likely than not to be, you know, the guard from Iran pushing the buttons on this.
How do you explain that the Saudis, who have spent billions on American arms, in fact, that's one of the reasons for the close ties between Trump administration and Saudis, didn't protect them at all?
I'm actually shocked at it, and I think part of what you're seeing now is probably a lot of work within the kingdom about how do we protect our critical infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
So much of this, too, can be traced back to the very beginning of the Trump administration when he first backed out of the nuclear deal with Iran. Yeah. It was so predictable even then. All the experts were telling us right then that this is what was going to happen, that yep. we were going to create more tension within Iran. They were going to react in a way that is what they're exactly doing now. And now the sanctions themselves on top of that are just making the situation even worse. I mean, it's a real failure of the Trump administration to really develop relationships with foreign countries like Iran and especially Iran and not understanding the balance between Iran and Saudi Arabia and how the two have to work hand in hand, and you can't ignore one and work with the other.
There's another element that I don't think we can discount too, is that I don't know
go to a break. Go ahead.
What the level of unrest within Iran is as well, and right. you can't discount that the regime is trying to hang on and head off both unrest within their own population while pushing the Saudis.
Well, it's because these sanctions have had a real effect.
Real effects.
All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Terry Gibson, Chris Churchill, Bob Gibson, and Rosemary Armeo. We welcome your letters. We have these letters. This one from Rick, who says, using the word advisor in regards to Donald Trump is kind of a joke. The only advice he takes from is Fox News and Breitbart. They are dictating to his sad little insecure brain. Gene yep. says, kudos to Rosemary, who actually spent time in the Middle East, for calling out talking points and giving another viewpoint. That from Gene. Alan says, I agree with Alan that Israel was created as a Jewish state. And no, Rosemary, the idea of driving the Jews into the sea is not an outdated notion. Yes, the people do get along in most of the cities in Israel. In fact, some of the Hasidim are the greatest supporters of the Palestinians because Israel is not a Jewish law state. They don't side with Israelis. However, what is disturbing about this latest vote is that Netanyahu will not concede or so he says. He has announced that because the media was biased against him, his loss is not valid, leaving the question, will Trump do the same?
That's a very interesting observation, and I'll go back to there. There's so many things that we should watch with what happened with the Israeli election right now, because I think we could see a replay in 2020 here.
Neil says, of course, Obama or any other president would want a DNR that shares his views. The problem is, does anyone know from moment to moment what Trump's views really are?
I think, you know, as I've said here before, I think we do know what his instincts are, at least. I mean, and Bolton was 180 degrees in the opposite direction. And like I said last week, if you want to give Trump credit, you can say, well, good for him for bringing in somebody who Fox News, Tucker Carlson, hated, and somebody who strongly disagrees with the president's instincts, or you could see that as a positive, not a negative.
Well,
I kind of think if you took people like Tucker Carlson took off his list that he didn't like, we wouldn't have many people left. Yes?
Listen, the president governs by what Tucker Carlson said. I'm not kidding. Well. He lobbied for the firing of Bolton. I mean, if you watch Tucker Carlson's show every night, and I'm not suggesting that you put yourself through that, but if you do,
yeah, that's what we have you for.
You will see the policies come 4 or 5 days later. I mean, Tucker, that's his favorite show, and Tucker lobbied the president on the phone, supposedly, according to Politico, to get Bolton fired, and Bolton was fired.
So Looney Tunes isn't his favorite show? I'm sorry, I always thought that.
Alan, go ahead.
I think it's terribly important to remember that this president has a philosophy, which is to remain in office. And he is a guy who will go one way or the other, depending on what the moment dictates. He will like somebody, he will need somebody, and then he'll throw them out. That's what this is all about, and it'll keep on being this way.
Well, I mean, that's true of every president. They're all egomaniacs. And Terry said earlier that every previous president, has wanted a national security advisor who they could take advice from and who they could have a good, disagreement with. I just don't think that's true. Politicians have looked for yes men since the beginning of time.
What about a team of rivals, Chris? Come on. It's going way back.
I don't think this is about particularly the NSA officer. He does this to every person he appoints, and it's classic narcissistic behavior.
Absolutely.
First he appoints someone who appears to agree with him, and it aggrandizes him. He goes, this is the best person ever. This is amazing. No one's ever had anyone this good.
Or Rosemary.
Then there's a disagreement or disaffectation, which is usually very quickly, and then he just disowns them. It's classic narcissistic behavior.
But it was
clear
from the beginning that he and Bolton didn't agree on a lot of things.
That's true.
Which was why it was such a surprising,
He needed Bolton at a particular moment, and when he didn't need him, off with his head. That's what this is about.
So if Tucker Carlson is the one that told him to hire Bolton,
Tucker didn't tell him to hire Bolton. Tucker told him to get rid of Bolton.
I'm sorry, right. Okay. So I'm wondering who told him to hire O'Brien. I'm wondering where that direction came from.
I don't know. Well, I guess we'll find out.
Roll back the tape. Yeah. So meanwhile, before we leave this part of the world completely, and go into Lewandowski land, the Trump administration announced that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo would fly to the Persian Gulf on Wednesday to discuss a response to an attack on Saudi oil facilities. What do we make of the trip? Spur of the moment. He's good for that, right?
He's like going to get marching orders, and he better obey because they cut up and kill people who they disagree with. It's just appalling. Why are we listening to what Saudi Arabia wants?
Well, according to the White House, it will include stops in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates.
The two participants in the Yemen war, by the way.
Well, Pompeo is a spokesperson for the president for all practical purposes. That's what his job is. And Trump has made it very clear that Saudi Arabia is a country that he values greatly and considers a friend and wants to be a part of and wants to help in any way possible. And so it from Trump's point of view, it makes perfect sense to be sending him over there.
Well, sort of. I mean, I also think that the Trump campaign is looking at this as an absolute worst case scenario, this idea of the neat little proxy war that they had going on in Yemen now expanding to an all-out flame-out in the Middle East a year before elections. And of all the promises of taking our troops out of these and not being the world's police, police force, all of a sudden we could get pulled into a real shooting war. And if you look at the Iranian military, it's not going to be a cakewalk. It's not going to be an easy thing. So I'm sure there are elements within the Trump organization that are saying this is horrible for our reelection campaign on either side. We either look like we're weak and not supporting the Saudis versus the Iranians, or we're going to be strong and therefore our military is now going to be involved in a very expensive conflict in both lives and money.
For what it's worth, I agree.
That's good.
It's also horrible for our country. We have so many issues here in our own country that are really deserving of substantial financial investments and attention from this president, and they're being completely ignored. And to go over and spend all this time and money, billions and billions and billions, and helping Saudi Arabia, a real questionable friend, and I say that in quotes, when we should be focused on our own issues here, is just a horrible situation.
But couldn't we say the exact same thing about every other president leading up to this one? I mean, one of the things that frustrates me is that we were always told that we kind of had to be friends with Saudi Arabia because we needed their oil. We were dependent on their oil. Now, supposedly, we're energy independent, and yet we still seem to be, completely hand in hand with Saudi Arabia. It's to me, it's frustrating. And I know there's a bigger geopolitical angle to this whole thing, that if you're going to have Iran on one side, you've got to have a friend who counterbalances that. But it's as you said,
you know, with the Khashoggi thing. Saudi Arabia is not a friend that you
And it's ironic to me that, you know, we actually have gone after our friends, our people who have stood with us. You know, I'm thinking about NATO. I'm thinking about Germany and France and the UK. And Trump has insulted them and talked about how they need to pay more money for American defense. Where's that conversation right now?
And also, we haven't talked about Russia. We did not defend Ukraine. Yes. And they were not a NATO partner. But they were only not a NATO partner because we said, oh, you don't have to be. We'll take care of you. And we didn't. Yeah. And that was Putin involved. And I think he's sitting in that Kremlin just rubbing his hands over this. This hurts the U.S. It hurts. It hurts Israel. It will hurt Iran. It will hurt Saudi Arabia. And then who is the dominant power in the Middle East?
See, go back to what you said, though, Robert. Like, Iran obviously knows that Trump would – that another war would be an electoral disaster for Trump, right? So, I mean, that weakens his position. They know that all this bellicose bluster is ultimately just that because he can't go to war. He can't get us entangled in another Middle Eastern conflict because he ran – and I think he was right to do so, but he ran as a candidate who wasn't going to do that sort of thing. And there's just no appetite in this country for another Middle Eastern conflict.
Real quick, Bob, then we got to go to break.
The problem, though, Chris, is that they could, that because we're playing chicken with each other, and there could be an event that steps over the line, that crosses a line that makes it impossible for us not to react with kinetic military response. And that the problem
for example, if they attack us.
Yes.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, as Chris would say, more bellicose bluster. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Terry Gibson, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo. We have letters like this from Jody who say we should not forget the killing of Khashoggi and our possible rush to support the Saudis, or has this been forgotten by our media already? Well, we've brought it up several times on the show
today. Not by the media. It's been forgotten by our administration.
Also, Bobby writes, in answer to your comments, word is that Pompeo is the one who strongly pushed O'Brien as the new advisor. O'Brien supposedly has worked well with Pompeo at the State Department. I'm reading that Trump saw O'Brien as, quote, a winner due to his successful negotiations to gain release of hostages, including the rapper recently. Also, that he comes straight from central casting. He looks the part.
Well, you know, a hostage negotiator has to be a good hostage negotiator has to be very good at getting inside the minds of other people, understanding how they think, what their attitudes are, what their behaviors are. That could be extremely useful.
Yeah, talking them into things they don't really want to do.
That could be extremely useful to us as Americans who want to see someone put pressure on this president to act in a responsible way. So we'll see.
And the Pompeo angle really does make sense. So thank you for that letter.
All right. This from the Washington Post about Corey Lewandowski. I'm just going to read the first paragraph because it's funny. Corey Lewandowski refused to answer questions, talked over lawmakers, and mocked Democrats for their investigation of President Trump. He lectured a congressman for saying the tooth fairy wasn't real, ribbed another for a failed presidential bid, and even promoted a potential run for the U.S. Senate. This before the House Judiciary Committee subpoenaed Trump's former campaign manager, hoping to learn more about his testimony to Robert Mueller. It was, by most accounts, a performance, and one of those performances that was aimed at an audience of one, and that audience, of course, being the President of the United States. It was very hard to watch. I tried to watch a few minutes of it. It was difficult.
Hard. I missed the part about the tooth fairy. In fact, I couldn't watch at all.
I hope no 5-year-olds were watching.
I
hope they're not listening.
I know.
I hope my own daughter's not listening.
Yeah. Well, I think that was Lewandowski's argument, actually, Chris.
Yeah. Wait a second. If you let your 5-year-old watch those hearings, that's child abuse, so you should not admit it.
You know, it was, but it was classic.
She loves that kind of stuff. She loves politics.
It was the classic behavior that has become standard within Trump's administration, the Republican Party now. I was thinking about this. You know, Democrats over the last couple of years have framed themselves as being the party of resistance. It's all about resist, resist, resist. I'm a member of the resistance. But if you think about it, the Republican Party is actually doing a phenomenal job of resisting. They have resisted everything. They've resisted allowing us to put forth a Supreme Court nominee when Obama was president. From that point on, since Trump has gotten in office, they have resisted every possible law, every possible precedent, every place, every position they can go and resist it, they do. And Corey's testimony did the same thing. He just ignores them.
But Terry, at the same time they're doing this, though, they're fundamentally weakening the foundations that this entire system is built on.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what shouldn't get lost in, you know, and we're talking about the bad behavior of this childish, this man-child. What shouldn't get lost, though.
Which one are you talking about?
tweet all you like about it, but he confirmed that the president told him to obstruct justice.
Yep.
So what can't get lost in the Tooth Fairy comments and everything is the fact that you now have two data points. You got the Mueller report and you have Corey coming out saying that, yes, it is indeed true. So this is going to add a lot more fuel to the potential fire.
But
it was difficult to watch because of how incredibly disrespectful it was. I mean, we get letters all the time that we're disrespectful to each other. This is the U.S. Congress, and he had a subpoena, and he just took questionable, disrespectful stands and yelled at it. It was awful.
But can I tell
you? And you can imagine if the shoe was on the other foot.
Oh yeah.
In other words, you can only imagine if the Republicans had the Congress, and it was
like a Benghazi hearing.
Unbelievable.
When he said, Alan, the part about you Democrats care more about hating the president than you do loving the country, it's just the reverse. They care so much about supporting and loving him that they are denigrating everything that this country once stood for, the principles you're
talking
about.
So can I go back
Bob?
One more step and say, I mean, if you watch this guy for 5 minutes on cable news when he was on CNN, how did the Democrats not know that they were up against that?
I know. This was Corey being Corey. This is just who he is. I mean, I don't know why anybody would expect anything different.
I think they did, and the answer was just what Bob pointed out. They did get two admissions. He did say, yeah, it's true. He did obstruct justice. He also said, yeah, I have no obligation to tell the truth to the media, which we knew, but now it's on the record by...
But he's been instructed. He's been instructed to answer questions that way, just like Brett Kavanaugh was instructed to answer questions that way, who was also rude and disrespectful.
Yeah. Not to that degree, though. I mean, many of the
individuals that have come forth and testified before various committees, whether it's this one or another one, that have come from the Trump administration, have been disrespectful in some shape or form.
Okay, so what does it mean to American government?
It means that we are in great danger of losing this democracy, that if the president can tell people to not answer questions, even if they didn't even work in the White House— Where does this end? I mean, I am so...
We know where it ends. We know where it ends. We're there. This could be the end of what we have of the founders, of the founding fathers, and what they put up in all of this. This is really alarming.
I think there's real pressure on Nadler.
I would take a deep breath. I don't think this is the end of American democracy because Corey Lewandowski was rude to a few people. And
The president has
told all of them, you don't go up there. You don't respond to a subpoena by the United States Congress.
An equal branch of government, he said, disregard. And yes, this will go to the Supreme Court, but he's also been undermining that, too. Yeah. I do think this is a dangerous thing.
The line seems to be that you keep hearing on cable news is that he was playing to only the audience of the president. I actually think he was playing to primary voters in New Hampshire, too.
Yep.
I mean, the irony is that he could return to that building as a senator, you know, and talk about the hyper-partisanship, throwing, you know, fuel on the fire of hyper-partisanship. If a guy like that gets elected to the Senate.
Yeah, but Chris, what does that mean? A person who's been subpoenaed by the Judiciary Committee can go and not answer questions and then actually become elected to the same body? I mean, that is terrifying.
It's even more cynical than that, Terry, because he was not a member of the administration.
Right.
So all the rules on executive privilege have no bearing on him, which now has to be adjudicated in court, which will take several years. It's a cynical thing to just push this down the line and stall. It's so bad.
If Congress can't subpoena people and hold them accountable for actually answering the questions they want, then what power do they have? And so how can we actually expect this president, after the election, to just leave office as normal, assuming he loses? Which is what we hope, was what I hope, obviously. I mean, I'm very scared that scenario is developing and becoming more and more real every day, that he is finding ways to resist the tradition of our democracy, to resist the rules of our democracy, and we'll find a way, maybe as Netanyahu is doing in Israel, yes, to stay in office.
Well, and Terry, what bothers me is that where does it stop? I mean, so you never want a, you know, you never want a bureaucrat deciding which laws they're going to enforce or not enforce. And when you start to see this behavior and see the behavior rewarded by the administration, what comes next to me is that people are going to pick and choose the laws that they like, which means that we become a lawless mm-hmm. land. I do worry that, you know, each one of these steps further weakens the rule of law. And what bothers me particularly about the GOP is that they've always stood for the rule of law. Even when I disagreed with the law, they stood for the rule of law. And right now, it is a lawless party. It is that the lawlessness of Trump is starting to permeate the entire GOP. And they've lost their
minds. You're right. I think we all know that this is a very dangerous time. So we can stop talking about that as much as what to do now. What do you do when the entire democracy is up for grabs?
I just don't agree with that fundamental premise. I don't think the entire democracy is up for grabs. We're living through a very partisan period, a very emotional period, a very angry period, a period where politics has become overly nationalized, when really we should be worrying about what's happening in our cities and towns a lot more than what's happening in Washington. But I just don't disagree that democracy is up for grabs. I think that's
overstating it. It is when the United States Congress says, come before us, which is our privilege, and we are not allowed to do that. And where does it go from there? You could be sitting there, and we should have a copy of this tape, Chris, because at some point, if it gets much, much worse, and this continues, this paradigm continues, then where are we?
And as further proof that the democracy is in trouble, look at what's happening with California's EPA rules. He's also attacking federalism. There's nothing more basic to the United States than federalism.
Yeah, cities and towns, are actually very focused on their problems. States, too. The problem is that they are not able to access the help they need from the federal government, and that's where the real crisis is right now. And California is a prime example of what we're dealing with.
The air pollution standards that they had for cars and light trucks, the Trump administration plans to revoke those. Obviously it's going to set up a legal battle,
mm-hmm.
but it does show yet another move, environmentally, but also impact on the state.
He's brought down church and state. He's impacting the separation of powers and the co-equal branches of government, and now federalism. If that's not an attack on democracy directly, Chris, what would you define that as?
Well, I don't agree with the California thing. I don't agree with what they're doing, but the federal government granted that power to California in the first place. If the federal government grants it, the federal government can take it away.
Wait, grant her what power?
The power to regulate air emissions.
It's a waiver.
They have a special waiver. If you get that from the federal government, that's not. Mm-hmm. I love federalism. I'm all for it, but this isn't really an example of federalism. Mm-hmm. I do think California should be able to set its own standards, mm-hmm. but again, I don't see that as an attack on democracy. I just think that is a foolhardy move.
Mm-hmm. I'll push back respectfully, Chris. You know, it's not just in California. Let's take California for instance. It's not just to me the air quality issue. It's the issue of homelessness too. That's now becoming a very political issue. And I look at that as sort of a basic constitutional question. What is the federal government's role in homelessness? And going back to Terry's comments, you know, that's a local issue that should be controlled by the states. What happens if they send law enforcement in to, quote, clean up the camps, unquote?
Mm-hmm. Well, want to talk about an attack on federalism, a more direct attack on federalism. It hasn't exactly happened yet. Is the administration's move to override local zoning laws in an attempt to tackle homelessness. I mean, you can certainly argue that local zoning laws are responsible for the cost of housing and therefore homelessness. But is that the federal government's responsibility to override those laws? I don't think that it is, but the Trump administration is doing that.
Right. And you know, take that as let's take that whole issue of takings a step further. The wall. the wall becomes so, you know, the fact that the president wants the wall and has staked his reputation on it, he's going to push it through at all costs, including illegal taking of property in order to put the wall up. And again, this is where—
But see, that's where I would push back a little bit on this whole idea that democracy is under threat. He hasn't been able to do that. We're 3 years in now, and that wall is still not there. I mean, if he was this dictator who could just get whatever he wants done, that wall would be up already.
Yeah, but here's my problem, though. Where's the pushback? With the exception of some Democrats that often come across more shrill than they do rational, I'm not hearing any of the principal positions out of any moderate or GOP candidates or office holders.
I would actually disagree with that. Yes, it is quiet, but there are GOP senators who are doing things behind the scenes. Like Mike Lee has proposed a bill that would strip the president of his emergency powers. 17 Republican senators have signed on to that bill. No Democrats have.
Yeah, but Chris,
that's the kind of thing.
Why, Chris? Why haven't Democrats signed?
I don't know.
Because they think he's. I can tell you why. Because they think he's going to lose the election. They don't want a Democratic president doing to them what Trump is doing to us right now.
But we should. But if there's one thing that should happen in the Trump era, it's that Congress should claw back its powers. Right?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I'm in complete agreement on that.
Mike Lee and 17 Republicans have signed on to a bill that would do that. The Democrats haven't signed on to it.
By the way, that's
a big mistake.
By the way, that's why the taking of the United States Senate by the Democrats is probably the most important thing we should be talking about when we talk about how to bring back this whole thing to some kind of sanity. That's where it is.
And it should probably be where the Democratic Party puts all of its resources, too. I mean, they really need to focus on that. And, you know, you could argue that focusing on this impeachment hearing and trial, it may not be worthwhile. If they don't have a better strategy to deal with people who won't answer their questions, where is it going to get us?
Well, is there a better strategy than taking it to court where it's engraved in a law stronger than – I think Nadler and Pelosi have the most important jobs in government right now, and it is to challenge this. And I applaud the emoluments clause, even though I don't think it will really have an effect on Trump because he'll be out of office before it's decided. But in all of our history, we've not had to decide that before, and it needs to go into court.
Everything that people object to with Trump, be it, you know, the emergency on the wall, right, his ability to declare war, his ability to just unilaterally enforce terror or impose tariffs, all of that, that's all congressional power that Congress has given
you're
away.
Right.
And Congress needs to take that power back.
You are right.
Alan, you're going to say?
Yes, and how do they do that, Chris?
They do it with things like the bill that Mike Lee has proposed, which would strip him of his ability to declare an emergency.
And you got a minority of the majority. That's not going to work.
He still requires the Republican Senate to.
Well, yeah, come on.
The Republican Senate is not going to adopt that bill. Mitch McConnell is not going to allow that to happen.
17 Republicans have signed on to it. No Democrats have. So you can say you can knock them for their lack of courage, but behind the scenes, some of them are trying to do things.
You know, I love this business about behind the scenes or secretly or behind the scenes. Come on. You know, you got a bunch of feckless Republican senators who have had all kinds of opportunities to stand up to this president and were scared to death.
Well, if you have 17 Republicans who have agreed to vote for this in the Senate, if you got the Democrats
because
behind it, too, it would pass. I mean, it would pass.
Because they know they're in trouble. And by the way, if it's going to pass, Mitch McConnell is not going to let it up for a vote. Now, you know that, and I know it.
It isn't going to get signed. Okay, so.
You know, my only disagreement, Alan, is that he will let up for a vote, but it won't be signed into law until after November of 2020.
And you know it's going to be
signed at
wait,
all.
Wait,
what are we
wait,
talking about?
Wait. You just said, Mitch McConnell will let it up for a vote. When in the history of this whole scenario that we've been going through, has Mitch McConnell ever allowed anything that would embarrass this president?
So I think what's going to happen in Congress is similar to what happened in Wisconsin when Walker was voted out of office and a Democratic governor was coming in. The GOP went and they stripped the governor of all of his powers. This is a playbook that we've seen before and we're going to see again. Anything that they're turning a blind eye to right now that Trump is doing, they're going to work really hard to make sure that a Democratic president can't do the same thing to him.
Joe, I just want to go back before we lose time on this California story to point out, let's not forget about what's happening here, which is how we started this conversation. We have a president who has decided that somehow it is in the best interest of our country to go to a state that has made phenomenal strides at reducing air pollution. I remember, many of you probably do too, going to L.A. back when you couldn't even see in front of you. It was just disgusting. They've made phenomenal strides. They've been a real leader in reducing air pollution. And that this president is going to go to the state and say that you can no longer do this. You no longer have permission to try to improve the quality of your air.
Incredible, isn't it?
And the irony to me, though, we can't lose sight of the fact that it was the GOP that actually put a lot of these. You know, it was the Republican Party that put in. Nixon created the EPA. If you think about the clean air push and clean water push in California, Reagan played a huge role in this. This is why, you know, sometimes I feel like I wake up in the morning, I'm in an Alice in Wonderland situation looking at the news because I just don't understand.
Well, healthcare, too.
Healthcare is a great example.
Really good example, Republican initiative.
The GOP has become the party of pollution and the party of lawlessness. That's what's happened.
Well, my friends, I think you've depressed us all enough, and we're good. We're out of time. Thank you very much for being with us. Alan Chartok, Terry Gibson, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo. Many thanks. We'll be back after this short break.